Please rise.
Thank you. Please be seated.
Thank you, everyone, for your patience. We have one final case on our calendar this morning, A23-1563, Herr versus State of Minnesota. Counsel, you're familiar with our procedures. You'll each have 15 minutes for your primary argument. The appellant has an additional 5 minutes of rebuttal at your option. We ask that you state your name and identify your client before you begin speaking, and let us know how we can reference you today. These matters are being recorded. That is the only recording that is permitted. And with that, counsel, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor, counsel, and may it please the court. I'm going to spend most of my time today talking about the extended period of time.
Introduce yourself, counsel.
Oh, sorry. Jonathan Simpson on behalf of appellant David Herr.
Thank you. Go ahead.
I'm going to spend most of my time discussing the extended period of time element, and then just briefly address the sentencing issue, and I'll rest on my brief on the significant relationship issue. In this case, the state produced no direct evidence that what happened during December 2018 happened over an extended period of time. Now, the state points out that the testimony of a criminal sexual conduct victim is by itself direct evidence. But in this case, what's important is when those instances happened in relation to each other. There's no other way to know if it happened over an extended period of time otherwise. And this isn't like an ordinary CSC case where this court has repeatedly said the state need not prove when specifically instances of CSC happen. That's because the venue element is usually the only place where the timing issue comes up. In those cases, we say that the defendant committed the act on or about such and such a date, and that date doesn't actually matter. Whether it happened on August 4th or August 10th, it's irrelevant. The issue in those cases is, did it happen? Here, however, the extended period of time is an essential element of the crime. And it can't just be multiple acts over a period of time. The statute specifically says extended. Extended has a specific meaning, and the state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that those instances happened over an extended period of time. So I think based on that, this court should apply the circumstantial evidence standard of review on the specific element of...
But we know the period of time because it was, and the state conceded that it's 5 or so days in December, right?
That's the total period of time, but...
But are you arguing that they had to prove exactly which date and time of day within that period of time?
In connection...
To satisfy the standard?
I think there needed to be some specific testimony about when those incidents happened during that window of time, because it is entirely consistent with her testimony that appellate entered the bedroom on one night, engaged in acts of abuse, left, and then came back shortly thereafter, and that nothing else happened during that stay. There's nothing in her testimony that says it even happened on different nights. So that's why I'm saying that to conclude that this happened over an extended period of time, the jury had to infer that timing from something other than her testimony. As a result, this court should use the circumstantial evidence standard of review. And based on that, I think the court should reverse the conviction on count one, because there are certainly circumstances consistent with appellant's innocence based on her testimony. To that end,
you're not making any claim as to the count that the jury did find, the single count where they found he was guilty?
No, Your Honor. Other than if the court decides that there is not a significant relationship, that would negate the conviction on count three. But She testified to all the other elements of count one, which is also count three.
And if the state, if you, the state had presented evidence that you thought was sufficient, that sexual contact happened on two or three different days within, or 24-hour periods within that window, you know, whatever it was in December, 5 days or so, would that satisfy the state's burden then?
I would argue no.
Okay. And then why not?
We don't have, I was unable to find a published case that defined exactly what an extended period of time is. And I think given the allegations in her testimony regarding the sexual contact, that contact over that period of time is not an extended period of time. This court said that an extended period of time in an unpublished case is of relatively great duration. And I would argue that the 4 nights that it could have been was not relatively great in duration.
So how are we, if we were to go down that path with you, how are we to, as a question of law, determine the parameters of what is or is not an extended period of time? I mean, if like, set aside the question of whether something's a single behavior incident or not. A victim is kidnapped and over an 8-hour period of time is repeatedly raped. I mean, could that, and the victim not free to go, could that be an extended period of time? I mean, does it depend on the circumstances, I guess is all I'm asking.
I think I would say it depends on the circumstances. What is a relatively great duration for one form of victimization is not relatively great for another. In a situation where a person is being violently raped for a period of hours, that strikes me as a relatively great duration for that crime. I think given these circumstances, the conduct that was testified to by NB was not an extended period of time.
As a matter of fact or as a matter of law? And I mean, it seems to me like we were just discussing that this is a matter of fact, given the particular circumstances, that depending on what happens and the circumstances under which the thing happens, it could be considered an extended period of time, particularly to a victim.
Right. It seems like it's a combined issue of fact and law in that you have the definition of an extended period of time being relatively great duration, and then what that means depends on the facts of the case.
And then what do we do here when this question is presented to the jury and the jury is instructed to use their common sense and evaluate all the evidence in determining whether the elements of the crime have been satisfied? Or proven beyond a reasonable doubt, I should say.
Well, I think what we're doing right now is an appropriate way to handle this. We defined at trial, the definition was provided, the instructions were provided, and I think this case is somewhat unique because in the way that the state charged it and proceeded to trial. And just to recap what they did, the state alleged multiple acts over an extended period of time over a roughly 18-month period. Then they also broke down that time period into individual time periods corresponding to counts 2, 3, and 4. And the jury acquitted for all of the time periods except for December 2018. It was a longer range. It was December 1 to January 31st. But the only thing that happened that she testified to was during December. you know, ordinarily, had the jury convicted on all of the counts, then we wouldn't really be having this argument, because that 18-month period is an extended period of time. I just forgot where I was going with this. And I'm sorry, what was the question?
I think you've answered it, Counsel.
Okay, thank you. I like that. And again, there's two different standards that could apply to this, and I think we've touched on both. If the court agrees with me and goes with the circumstantial evidence, I think that, you know, that is one issue. And then this other issue of whether 4 days can be an extended period of time, which is a trickier issue, that's if there's the direct evidence standard. And like I said, I don't believe that there was direct evidence relating to when these acts occurred, because she didn't specifically say that the acts occurred on different days. So all we have is just he was in the room, he left, he came back, and we don't know when any of that happened.
Counsel, wasn't there some evidence or suggestion that she didn't talk about more than one incident occurring during that December visit? Am I misremembering that?
Well, the testimony wasn't exactly clear. The state asked a couple times, how many times did he come into your room? And on one occasion, she said, I don't know. On another occasion, she said, at least once. She did then talk about, her testimony did then suggest that there were more than one incident. So I'm not challenging this on there being multiple acts. It's just whether they occurred over an extended period of time. And her testimony did not address that.
Okay, but she only, as I remember, as to that specific December period, she didn't clearly indicate that there was a second, third, or fourth time during that time. She talked about the one where she had the Grinch pajamas or whatever on and that sort of thing. But
yeah, and that's that picture was from December 22nd. Mm-hmm. So that sort of cuts off the time period even more. Her visit was longer, but that was the start of it, apparently. And she said that was the first night that he came in, or that was the night that it started, and there wasn't any testimony about him coming in on other nights.
During that period of time.
Given my time, I'm just going to jump quickly to the sentencing issue. Now I'm asking this court to review the appropriateness of appellant's sentence in this case, and
was a motion made below for a downward durational departure? Because it seems like your argument really is that the district court abused its discretion by going below the presumptive sentence.
By not going below, correct. I don't...
By not going below.
I can't remember specifically during sentencing if they argued durational departure. However, I think in this case, given that we're looking at multiple acts over an extended period of time, and the fact that that conduct makes this a significantly higher severity level, that the court should use the same standard for consecutive sentences to determine if appellant's conduct as found by the jury justifies the 90-month prison commit. I don't believe that what NB testified to during the week of Christmas wasn't much more severe than what was alleged in count three, which is a single incident. The single incident in this case would be a 36-month stayed sentence, and the presumptive for the conviction on count one was a 90-month commit. I think given that this statute covers such a broad range of conduct, The court should take a look at the sentence for the to determine if it's disproportionate to the conduct. And if there are any other questions, I'll answer them. Otherwise, I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Isn't the real problem here is it the jury apparently did some compromising?
I don't think we can say what the jury did in their deliberation. All we can do is look at what the final results of those deliberations were.
Thank you, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you very much. Counsel, whenever you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court and opposing counsel. My name is Robert Yount, Assistant Hennepin County Attorney, and I represent the state of Minnesota in today's matter. Now, appellant has identified three issues on appeal. The first is a sufficiency challenge as to whether they shared a significant relationship. I join my friend across the aisle in resting on briefing on that. I welcome any questions, but I think the real nub of the appeal is the second and third issue. And turning now to the second issue, appellant is claiming that the state failed to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that there were multiple acts of criminal sexual conduct that occurred during the winter break of 2018. And I would like to start with where the parties disagree, and that is the governing standard of review. Now, to Steelman appellant's argument, he says, well, look, the victim here didn't give dates and times. The jury had to infer what those dates and times were. That inference means it relies on circumstantial evidence or a rational inference. Therefore, the circumstantial evidence test applies. That is a misapprehension and a misapplication of existing law. And this court need to look no further than the citation to State v. Al-Nasir that appellant relies on for that proposition. Respectfully, that's not what Al-Nasir held. What Al-Nasir held is that where there is an element of a charged crime that is supported solely by circumstantial evidence, then an appellant challenge to that particular element receives a circumstantial evidence test, that more stringent.
Turning right to the issue of what's an extended period of time, sure. How do you respond to appellant's argument that, I mean, the victim's testimony here at trial was pretty vague, and she did say, I don't remember, at least once, and then she uses some language that suggests, you know, it was multiple acts, but in looking at extended period of time, appellant argued, well, at least you have to show it was more than one evening. And so how do you respond to that argument, and how are we to interpret?
And I'd like to maybe incorporate some of the other previous questions from the panel on oral argument to respond to that. So I want to start from the top. I think it was Judge Frisch asked, is this a matter of fact or a matter of law that we're here? This is a question of fact. This is an essential element of the charge that the jury returned a guilty verdict on, finding that there are multiple acts over an extended period of time. The state takes a position this is a matter of fact left up to the jury. Now, the question on appeal then is what do we define as extended period of law? For that, I would direct the court's attention back to the State v. Suhan decision from 2007, cited in respondent's brief. There specifically is no statutory definition of that term, multiple acts over an extended period of time. And in fact, State v. Suhan says there is no particular definition. It's just up to the ordinary plain language construed by the jury. So to the question that this court is asking, how do we define that? That's up to the jury's providence based on the ordinary plain language. In fact, in this case, the jury submitted a questionnaire during its 3 days of deliberations about what the definition was. And the district court directed them back to its plain jury pattern instruction saying, it's up to you to make that decision as the jury because it's a question of fact.
But to Judge Siegel's point, what is the evidence of multiple acts occurring over that 5-day period?
And I would like to turn to that now because respectfully, I think that the record is more substantial than appellant makes it seem. So for example, I'm looking at pages 22 and 23 of respondent's brief. I think this is where we thoroughly go through the relevant testimony. I want to start by saying that it's very clear that at trial, she testified that there was a first time, that's a quote, and future times in plural. That necessarily means that there were at least two or more nights on which the abuse happened. Furthermore, her testimony continuously came back to the word sometimes. And the only way that someone can do something sometimes is if they do it on one occasion and don't do it on another. And so, for example, at trial, she testified that sometimes I would be on my phone or just trying to fall asleep. Those are two completely contradictory things. A rational inference from that can only be that there was one time where she was trying to fall asleep and one time where she was on her phone. She continues, so sometimes he would come back in the night, you're saying. Yes, again, sometimes. And so what that means, that at minimum, there was at least one night where at least one instance of sexual conduct occurred, and there was a future incident where on at least one night he came in twice during that 24 or that
evening.
Was she
referring to that December time frame or all of the time frame?
This testimony is specifically with regard to the December time frame. And I will note that that is consistent with what she initially disclosed to Officer, I apologize, I'm blanking on the officer's last name, but it's jury trial exhibit 16 and 16A is the transcript. She specifically disclosed very similar types of conduct, specifically with regard to the December time frame. And so this court should apply the traditional standard of review. And I can return to that if the court would like me to finish on that thought. But by looking at the record here, it shows that there were at least two nights, up to four nights, where the sexual abuse occurred. As a question of fact, the jury stands on solid ground in returning a guilty verdict on that essential element.
You've said it's a question of fact, but at some point there would be a legal question going, whoa, this can't be multiple acts over an extended period of time as a matter of law. So how do we differentiate?
I would answer by saying that what this court has historically done is finding that the fact pattern where this question arises is sufficient. This court has never held what is quote unquote necessary to meet that definition. Because it's a question of fact, it's up to the jury. This court, specifically in State v. Suhan, declined to define it further because there is no statutory definition. So I would say in light of that binding precedent, there is no legal interpretation. For example, there's no legal interpretation being advanced by appellant, citing to dictionaries or anything about what quote-unquote extended period of time means. It's just a question of fact that's left up to the jury. Now, to the Chief Justice or Judge's point about, what do we do with that? Well, that's the lens of appellate review for sufficiency of evidence standard, where this court applies either the traditional standard that is more deferential to the jury verdict or the circumstantial standard that appellant's asking for. And then through that lens, this court looks to see, does the record support that? And on this case, it does. I mean, it's true that the jury returned acquittals in the other summer periods in 2018 and 2019, but that absolutely does not negate the fact that they returned a guilty verdict for that winter break of 2018, where she was there for six nights and where the abuse could have occurred over four separate nights.
Have, though. I mean, this is, I think, to your esteemed colleague's point, there's a question about whether this testimony from pages 71 to 76 of the transcript requires an inference that these multiple incidents, plural incidents, occurred shortly together or over an extended period of time. And help me with the evidence that indicates that. I understand the argument about the plurality, the use of the word sometimes, and the reference to sometimes coming back in the same night. But isn't there also, where's the direct evidence that it happened over this extended period, this five-day period, assuming that that's an extended period? Or whether we have to make inferences from the testimony to get there?
No, and I appreciate that question, and I want to start from a baseline, is that this court recognizes that victim testimony as to criminal sexual assault constitutes direct evidence. Period. That's just black-letter law. I think we all agree on that. And so the question is whether the victim...
She provided direct evidence of an assault, of multiple assaults.
Correct.
But she did not provide direct evidence of the timing, the extended period of time. That's my question to you. What is the direct evidence, which would be her testimony, of the time frame?
So, for instance, if all she had testified to was on at least one day all this happened, right? That would be very different from what we have here. We have her testifying to the fact that he came in at night multiple times. There's only one night and one day. So you have direct evidence, again, at minimum, showing that there were at least two different nights over that four-day period.
Where's the testimony of two different nights?
That goes back to what I was saying, where she said there was a first time at night, and there were future times at night. The only rational way to construe those two together is that there were at least two nights in which the abuse happened.
Why couldn't it be a rational inference to say a first time at night, at 9 o'clock at night, and then at 1 o'clock in the morning, the same time? Or would that be an extended period of time in your view?
If I may answer that question with 2 points. First of all, that's why it's critical that this court applies the traditional standard of review, because these searching questions, this court doesn't reach that. When you have a traditional standard of review, which is the appropriate standard of review for these types of claims, this court asks, is there evidence to support the jury verdict? It doesn't engage in that searching inquiry to see if there's rational inferences the jury could have drawn. I just want to pinpoint that because it's the state's position that there's direct evidence on each essential element, and under State v. Jones, the 2024 decision, when there's some direct evidence to support each essential element of the charge, it gets the traditional standard of review. Now, setting that aside, going to Your Honor's question, that's the only reasonable way to read her testimony as a whole. Because again, she's talking about, well, sometimes I was on my phone, but sometimes I was falling asleep. I mean, these are just different instances that she talks about. She talks about him engaging in different physical contact, touching himself, touching her, on different instances, asking her to touch him, asking if he can do things to her. I mean, if you take her testimony as a whole, which is approximately, you know, from 70 to 77, 79 of the transcript, and couple it together with her initial disclosures to the officers during the investigation, and couple that together with all of the other corroborating evidence provided by the witnesses about dates, times that she was at their house, and that she told them, and that they observed troubling behavior. I mean, if you take that as a whole, that amply supports the jury's verdict, particularly under a direct traditional standard of review for sufficiency of evidence, and even under a circumstantial evidence standard. Now, I'd also like to turn my remaining attention time with my remaining attention back to the sentencing issue. Appellant is challenging what is a nearly unfettered discretion by the trial court to enter a presumptive guidelines sentence. As cited in a respondent's brief, there is nothing that requires district courts to depart when there are potentially mitigating circumstances present in a record. In fact, that discretion that is afforded to trial courts really only draws a reversal from this court under two instances. One, if the record shows that the district court erred as a matter of law in considering factors that are inappropriate for the motion before it. Chief Justice Call, I want to go to your question earlier. I believe you asked, was it a dispositional or durational departure? It is my understanding it was a dispositional departure. I know that's what the bulk of the 30 pages of transcribed testimony was at the sentencing hearing, going to amenability of probation. I would have to go back and double check the record about whether the motion mentioned durational, but my understanding is that primarily they were arguing for dispositional, for probation. And then, going back to the two ways in which this court will reverse a district court's imposition of a presumptive sentence, is one is if the district court erred in relying on the wrong factors. That's not present here. The district court was weighing the appropriate factors for the amenability of probation for a dispositional departure. The second ground is if the district court refused to exercise its discretion, if it just abjectly failed to exercise its discretion, and for example, in previous cases, it has denied the defendant the opportunity to argue. That's also not present here. We have a 32-page transcript from the sentencing hearing where the district court heard victim impact statements on behalf of the state, as well as multiple individuals testify on behalf of the defendant. The district court heard it all and made a pretty good memorialized record on pages 31 to 32 of the transcript that it was weighing all of the evidence before it, saying that it was a tough case, but the legislature has determined that these are such troubling types of criminal acts that that's why we have the presumptive guideline sentence. And the last thing I'll say as to even if there was merit to consider whether the sentence was exaggerated, this was a bottom-of-the-box presumptive guideline sentence. This was the lowest presumptive guideline sentence that's contemplated by the sentencing guidelines. This is not a top-of-the-box. This is not an upward durational departure. This is the lowest presumptive sentence contemplated. And so I do believe that that shows the district court thoughtfully weighed the evidence in front of it. And the last thing I'll say is that, in fact, the state was asking for a top of the box. So this shows that the district court didn't even just go with what the state was requesting or advocating. The district court weighed it and thoughtfully entered a lower bottom of the box sentence. And given that deference owed to trial courts when they enter those guideline sentences, the state asks this court to affirm that. Unless the court has any other questions?
Counsel, you could have just charged this as one count of extended period of time and wrapped the offenses in. Had you done that, how would it have been handled at trial? You know, you get to into that issue, is does the jury have to find this to check beyond reasonable doubt and blah, blah, blah?
I'll start by saying that there's a baseline recognition that the prosecution has the authority to charge offenses as it sees fit. I don't think there's anything inappropriate with how the state charged it here. But to your honest question about what that would look like at trial, it's difficult to answer as a counterfactual. I think, and I should say, I am opining just based on, I don't have any, you know, this is outside the record, I don't have any information from the prosecutor. I think what they wanted to do was break it down into the different stays at the house to make it, you know, to make it more bite-sized and chewable for the jury. She was there during her summer breaks and her winter breaks from high school. And so the prosecution charged it during those periods of time, and then they charged one overarching multiple acts over an extended period of time. Now, if the jury had returned guilty verdicts on counts 2 or 4 or 5, I anticipate appellant would not be arguing whether multiple acts is not proven. That would be a clearer example of that happening, but that's not necessary. What's sufficient is what is present here, is that she was there for an extended period of time over winter break where multiple criminal acts occurred.
Thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you.
Counsel, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it.
Thank you. The issue here is that the state needs to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the acts occurred over an extended period of time. And counsel for the states, I think, is reading a bit too much precision into NB's testimony. Her testimony at trial was very, like the court has mentioned, vague. You know, sometimes he would come in and do this, sometimes he would do that. And there is nothing in her testimony that is inconsistent with this happening over the course of one evening. And to his point where she said she was either falling asleep or looking at her phone, you can look at your phone while you're falling asleep. I do that almost every single night. On the sentencing issue, one thing I'll reiterate is that the box starts at 90 and it's also the presumptive sentence. Other than that, I don't believe I have anything else.
Anything else from the panel? All right, thank you very much, counsel. Appreciate the arguments and the submissions. The matter is submitted, and we will issue an opinion within the statutory period. And that concludes our calendar, and we are adjourned.